Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the Icelandic Roots podcast. Today is a very special one as we will dive deep into all things relating to the Icelandic sagas. So if you are ever interested in reading the sagas, or if you are very familiar with them, this episode will surely have a lot of tips and tricks and different ideas about how to approach the sagas. Our guest today is Jason Doctor, who is the Director of Public Outreach for the Icelandic Roots organization. He's very actively involved in different things. You've probably seen him and heard from him if you are actively involved within this community. But specifically for this episode, we're going to talk about all things relating to the saga. So I hope you enjoy and learn lots in this very special episode. Well, Jason, thank you for agreeing to do this with me.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Yeah, okay. So maybe we can get started with, you could explain, and I know you've done a podcast episode with the podcast before. It was prior to Owen and I taking the helm for the podcast, you could say. But then you were also on the Icelandic Roots trip last summer,
yeah,
which I was on as well. And so I got to know you through that trip, as well as all the other fantastic members of the community that were there with us. And I've been really interested in how you approach the Icelandic sagas. And of course, spending time in Iceland and getting to know my Icelandic roots there and just trying to immerse myself in the heritage, you can't help but get involved in the sagas. Yeah. But certainly, I do remember, I guess, maybe being younger, the Icelandic sagas seemed very distant and out of reach. But I think any sort of, like, this is the same feeling I had when we studied Shakespeare in high school. Right. It just seemed like very outdated, not relevant, hard to grasp, very dry. My perspective has changed over time, but it has been quite the process to be able to open myself up to actually reading and enjoying the sagas. So maybe you can share a bit about how that process has been for you and what has piqued your interest with the Icelandic sagas.
Sure. So let me just step back a bit to give like a frame of reference for what they are. So there's about 40 of these Icelandic family sagas, which are stories of families of the first settlers. They were written about 200 to 300 years after the first settlement, between 200 and 300 years. And so it would be the equivalent of maybe me writing about, you know, George Washington or something, or Thomas Jefferson, or any of the founders of the United States. It was a long, long before me. And they were really written at a time when Iceland was coming under Norwegian control, and there was a fear that being Icelandic, the Icelandic identity would somehow go away and be kind of engulfed by, you know, perhaps a Norwegian identity, or the colonization of Iceland would result in that. So in some respects, it's similar. They were facing kind of similar challenges as we face today, preserving the Icelandic heritage, right? They were saying, oh my gosh, we got to write this stuff down. We got to get this all on paper.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about the sagas, I think, is that, you know, although they were written in the 1200s, they really embody, like, many of the human relationships and characteristics that we can identify with today. Mm-hmm. There is an overlay of other social issues that were going on at the time, which is interesting and important to understand, I think. But generally, you know, although they had the Northern Lights and the volcanoes and the glaciers, they really weren't interested in that stuff. It's all about the relationships of the people, which I think makes for sort of like a type of drama that we're all very familiar with when we turn on the television and watch a show on a Saturday or evening or something like that. So you would ask me, like, my approach to reading them. I think it's a formidable amount of writing. So if you've ever seen the books, the Icelandic sagas published all together, it's almost like a Encyclopedia Britannica. It just sits on your bookshelf from,
right,
you know, about 3 to 4 feet long of books, you know. And so that seems overwhelming, certainly to anybody. And so I think like the best approach and what I've found useful is that, you know, the stories are really good and really engaging. The writing is very simple, but because there's so much information in them, it's fine to read, to, you know, listen to a podcast about a story. There's a great podcast called Saga Thing, which kind of runs through all the different Icelandic sagas, and then go back and read it.
Mm.
You know, watch a movie about a saga, read a synopsis, and then you'll have like those anchors in your mind so that you can go back and really focus in on the story. Mm-hmm. One other thing I'd say is that the kind of a turnoff to a lot of people is the genealogy. So whenever you start a saga, it starts with a really long genealogy of who this person's great, great grandparents were, where they came from in Norway, how they got, how, you know, who were their kids, and it goes on and on. And you have to wade through that to get to the actual story.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's relevant to the story, but one thing that's useful is to draw a little tree. Just have a piece of paper and a pencil next to you and draw a little tree as you read, so you can just refer back to that when you need to.
Yeah, interesting. I find that very fascinating, that first bit that you were saying, sort of contrasting it to as though if you were writing about maybe the founding fathers of the United States, and that sort of contrast to United States history. I think that's kind of a useful frame to have, and that the Icelandic people, like you said, were dealing with some of those same issues that are dealt with really with any culture or the sort of threat. I don't know if they would they have viewed it as a real threat from Norway coming over and ruling them.
Oh, I definitely think so. Nancy Marie Brown has a great book called Song of the Viking, and it talks about that period of time when Snorri Sturluson and Gudmundur the Good were kind of creating issues around the relationship with Norway so that it became favorable for Norway to colonize Iceland and eventually Denmark when Norway came under control of Denmark. But if you read that, her book and other writings about that time, you see that people were extremely upset about this. No one was really happy about it. It was a big deal.
Yeah. And in that sense, maybe literature in this way was just one of the tools that they had that they maybe thought could at least maintain their sense of community that they had, or maybe even, I don't know, maybe even do more for their cause. So these are very like good perspectives that you're describing around the sagas and then the whole general history. And so you mentioned Nancy Marie Brown's books as sort of historical reference points to provide more context. But how have you really been able to develop this understanding? Has it just been like through the process of reading the sagas, reading other historical pieces, going to Iceland as well? Has these just given you different reference points in your brain to sort of conceptualize this?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, the other key factor, I think, is that one distinct difference between the settlement period and how we live now is that we are a nation of laws, and we can enforce those laws with, you know, law enforcement, police, sheriff, etc. Back then, they were a nation of laws, but they were sort of responsible for their own enforcement of those laws through basically a revenge culture, and having to sort of abide by certain rules around what you did if someone wronged you or harmed someone in your family. And there were legal procedures you had to follow. But also there were basically revenge expectations for what you were supposed to do. And there were also really strong gender roles. So men were kind of hyper-masculinized and women not so. Of course, people fall more in the middle. So one common theme in these sagas is that women often drive the violence because they also just, you know, like men, they have grudges and animosity, et cetera, but they couldn't express them through their gender role. So they would express them by having other people do violence, their the people who they had enslaved, they'd send them out there or to do it, or their husbands. And the men also, you know, were reluctant to engage in violence because they paid the ultimate cost, right? So they would always want to maybe try for a more peaceful route rather than, so this, there is this kind of irony, right? That the men are supposed to be violent, but they want peace, and the women are supposed to be peaceful, but they want violence. And so really understanding that and the social structures of the time helped me to appreciate the sagas on another level, because I think a lot of people are turned off by them immediately because there is so much violence in the sagas. But it's not as though the saga writers necessarily condone the violence. It's that they, it's a byproduct of sort of the social structures, and they're commenting on that, and they're commenting on the difficult circumstances that people found themselves in. And that itself is the art of the saga, right? Trying to say, like, look at this guy's in this really difficult situation. He has to, you know, kill his friend because of the family connections. And, you know, it's, it makes for good drama.
Yeah. And I would say, thinking about Njál's saga, it almost, I get an impression sometimes with the descriptions of violence in that one, that the author is almost mocking it in a sense, or maybe writing it with a sort of sarcastic kind of humor, which maybe in my mind is almost implying that they know this is kind of over the top ridiculous, but it's just how it was. They're just reporting on what these men did at that time. Absolutely. Do you have any thoughts on Njál's saga? Some say it's the greatest of all the Icelandic sagas, and apparently one of the longest. This is one of the sagas that I approached first, and this was personally because I had a physical connection to it. When I was on the Snorri program, I stayed with relatives that lived at Bergþórsfólk. So literally the farm site where Njál's house was burnt down. And so I learned all about that while I was staying in this location. And then they gave me a copy of Njál's saga. So this was, I was kind of driven to reading it because of my circumstances,
right,
and then being gifted it and having some more context around it. But I don't know if I would have felt comfortable approaching it as one of my first sagas right off the bat, because you do ask people and they say it's kind of complex. It's, there's these different psychological narratives and lots to keep track of.
I agree. I mean, I think it's fantastic that you had that motivation and that you were staying on that farm, and it all, you could tie it to the physical place. And I think that's one thing that also is difficult, is that for many of us who don't live in Iceland, or even those who live in Reykjavik, you're not walking around the hillsides of the location and know all of the historical landmarks that our saga is referring to. By the way, Professor Emily Lethbridge at the University of Iceland has a wonderful website called Saga Places, I think, or sagamap.is. And if you're reading a saga, you can go to that map and you can look at the actual locations, geocoded places. But back to your question, I think, Njál's saga is very difficult as a first saga, and might be overwhelming. I typically recommend people read Hrafnkell's saga, which is only 24 pages long and has a lot of the characteristics of Icelandic sagas that kind of prime you for understanding what they're about. But I think, there's no question that Njál's saga is probably the one of the, you know, best sagas ever written in terms of its quality and literary quality, and also understanding. And it really does focus on the revenge culture and the gender roles quite a bit. That's sort of like the main component of it. And I think a third thing it focuses on is this belief, this pre-Christian belief that sort of carried over into the saga writing, which was this idea of fatalism, that everything is sort of preordained. And you can't change your fate. So you shouldn't be concerned about how you're going to die, because no matter what you do, it's already sort of been preordained is going to happen.
Interesting.
And so a lot of these, a lot of the saga stories will begin when things are going well, and then mm-hmm. something will happen that a curse or a bad event, and then things just kind of snowball through the rest of the story. And no matter how much people try to stop that, they can't stop fate. You know, they can't. And I think Njald Saga is a perfect example of that, because these two friends have to deal with a dispute related to their wives, and it carries on and on and on, and they simply cannot stop it. No matter what they do, they can't end this. And so they're part of the Icelandic sagas communicate that idea of fate, and that it's hopeless to try to change the course of history.
Hmm. That's interesting. What are your thoughts on that? Do you believe in fatalism?
No, not necessarily, but I think it's a compelling, I mean, it's a very different way of thinking than we think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one example that comes to mind is in the saga of the people of Vapnafjordr, where Brodhelgi asks his stepmother to, who's like a seamstress who kind of sees into the future about how he's going to die, or she had a dream and she's communicating that to him. And this happens in several of the sagas where you learn about how you're going to die. Hmm. And he wasn't even upset about it. He was just like, cause he just knew, you know, because of fatalism, they, you know, whereas you or I would be like, what? That's going to happen. That's the way it's going to be. Or maybe try to prevent it. We definitely feel like we have more agency, I think, than they did.
Yeah. I think it would have been easy to fall into that though, back in those days, and just the lack of understanding about the world compared to what we have in the modern age. And I wonder how much too of this was just the authors as they were writing these stories out and maybe having this realization like, wow, this is kind of crazy. It's as though this was fate, right?
Right.
And it's like, no matter what you could do could change that. But maybe that's just the perspective of as the authors wrote this down, because I don't know. I mean, at that point today, I mean, most people can like keep a journal and we go to school and we all do writing exercises. But back then, it's not like everyone was actually writing out stories and putting pen to paper. So I wonder if that was just a realization of these early days of really writing out stories and narratives, that the authors were really kind of having this thought of like, wow, it's as though we're all living in this story and our fate is predetermined and it's all written out on paper.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never thought about that. That's certainly could play some role.
Mm-hmm.
I think also the pre-Christian religion, the sort of pagan religion, promoted this idea of fate, and that the world was fated and the gods were going to die, and the tree Yggdrasil was sort of branching out with people's lives on the branches, and you know, the serpent was eating at it when bad things would happen, and that everything was sort of predetermined. And so I think that also, it's just a long, and that also relates to the interest in genealogy, to understand where you are on the tree and where you came from. These things are all connected. And so I think it ties back to sort of, in some respects, to pre-Christian belief.
Yeah. Interesting. And I'm also thinking now too, because of course, I think with Njal's saga, it was written in like maybe the late 1200s, but then set in a period like not too long after the actual settlement of Iceland. So maybe like 900 to year 1000, around somewhere in that frame. And then you mentioned too, again, going back to, you know, the first people in the United States and for like, let's say a 300 year period, like if you go back, I think it was something like the first five presidents of the United States had British accents.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's just one example of how much things have changed over that time period, is literally the voices of Americans have changed, but then also all the other aspects. And I think, of course, today it's time just goes by so quickly and things change like within decades, not only in centuries. But I do wonder how much, do you think we underestimate how much change took place back then? And from year 1000 to year 1300, were they still that similar, or maybe there was more changes that had taken place in the culture and the way they thought about the world?
Yeah, I think that it had changed. Well, the island was completely settled, and I think by the time the sagas were being written, there was the Viking Age was over, you know, and so there weren't people raiding and going out on raids, and there wasn't this kind of expansion that had been experienced from Norway out to the Western Islands and Ireland and Scotland and the Hebrides. And, you know, to some extent, some of the sagas comment on this a little bit. I think like Grettir's saga is one in particular that is about kind of a difficult guy, Grettir Asmundsson, who's kind of better suited for the Viking Age, better suited for a period of time where he could just handle himself. He's very strong, and he had a temper, and he was having difficulty sort of adapting to life in the sort of almost the saga period where things had settled down. And so that saga is in part a comment on that. Kind of like, you know, you hear people sometimes say, oh gosh, I wish I was a pirate. I'd really love to live back in those times. And I think Jimmy Buffett comments on that in one of his songs, but I think he kind of wishes he would had lived in Viking times, and the sagas address that issue and a couple hundred years after the Viking Age. So.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, I would like to actually backtrack a little bit again in your experience with the sagas, and then maybe we can get into a few more of the sagas specifically and ones that you are currently reading and working on summarizing and writing about in the Icelandic Roots membership group, which we can get into that in a moment as well. But I remember you mentioning once when you were first or getting into the sagas and like what first sparked your interest. Were you quite young when maybe you heard of the sagas, and what was that process like when you first started to think about reading them?
Well, I think there was always an interest in my family about our heritage, and we had books around about, you know, Norse mythology and the sagas and Halldor Laxness. And I think I got interested then originally. I didn't really dive in till much later, but I had sort of, you know, perused the sagas or some of them earlier as a kid. And I don't know. I think there's something about a historical narrative that is dramatic that I think makes it entertaining and inspiring and makes you want to read it. And then there's also this mystery of what is fiction and what is reality, because the sagas write about real people and also real events, but it's clearly also fiction and how it's all put together. And so you kind of, when you read them, you're kind of like, well, I wonder how much of that is true, how much of that actually happened. And as you dig deeper, you can sort of discern what might be real and what might not.
Yeah, fascinating. And so, yes, it is that you write about the sagas and you kind of break them down in I guess, like summary chapters. And maybe you can explain your thoughts behind this. And your
So Bryndís, who's involved with Icelandic Roots, is when I first started doing this, she said, Jason, you know, I want to help you with this because this is a big deal. And it used to be when I was a little girl, so Bryndís just turned 90, and she grew up in a turf house, at least part of the time. She said people would talk about the sagas around the dinner table, you know, and it was like a part of their daily life, and that's really changed. And so as I was getting going, it's kind of like learning how to ride a bike without training wheels. She would, you know, send me direct messages like, oh, well, consider this or consider that. And then at some point she's like, okay, you get it. You're doing a good job. You keep going. So that was really helpful. I think what the reason that I do it and the reason that I want to do it is that I want to keep it going, and I want to keep it alive, and I want to keep people talking about it. And I think the only way that we can do that in our times is through the digital age and through social media groups. And given that we're all so far away, living so far away from each other and don't have that close proximity.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I try to do is cover a saga over a course of several months, and I'll go chapter by chapter and summarize them just to get people interested in the story. Every Sunday morning, I'll post another one or schedule a post. And sometimes I'll combine a few chapters if not there's not much action happening. But that seems to be a way to give someone like that can read a Facebook post in a interest group, you know, some sort of regular rhythm. I'm like, oh, okay, what happened this week in the story?
Mm.
And to me, that helps keep it alive and keep people not think of it as something that happened in the past, but as something that is really for us, for everyone. Mm-hmm. So that's my small contribution.
Yeah. And you're currently reading the Saga of the Volslungs?
Yeah, the Saga of the Volslungs. And it's not an Icelandic family saga. It's a much older saga.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I was not familiar with that one, but just reading through your posts, it seems like there's so much of a just general, broad Norse kind of mythology focus. And I've also noticed, too, like, a lot of, like, animal references and kind of, like, pieces on that, which I thought was kind of more unique, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a saga that was written either in Scandinavia or Northern Germany, or it was told orally for centuries and then became a story that was written down in Iceland much later. But it's the story of the Volsung family and the Volsung kings. And as I point out in the interest group, it's connected actually to the Icelandic Roots database because there were some, I was a famous Viking, Rollo the Viking, who supposedly married someone from the saga. And so you can trace your ancestry back through the Volsung family that way in the Icelandic Roots database. But it's, it's an interesting story that covers several generations. And really, it's a useful way to understand sort of like what we know about pre-Christian ideas, because the saga really focuses on Odin's influence over people's lives from generation to generation. And the stories, again, has a strong focus on fate and the fate of the different characters, but also this idea that Odin wanted to, he was very interested in sort of understanding the origins of the world and also in keeping himself alive. And so he was building this army of the dead to fight at Ragnarok, which is the end of the world, so that he could sort of prolong his existence, even though apparently he knew that that was not going to work out. And so what he does throughout the story is identify really strong human fighters and warriors who he sort of recruits for his army by sort of making things go badly for them in battle, and then they die, and then they become part of the Einherji, or the Army of One, which are each fighting for him at Ragnarok. And if you've ever watched Game of Thrones, there's a similarity there with the Army of the Dead, which I think a lot of these modern fantasy stories sort of draw from these older stories and for inspiration.
Yes. Yeah, no, certainly. That's a whole nother side that a person could really just delve so deep into, is just all the modern day entertainment that has been based on or inspired by these old saga stories.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think one thing, it's hard to go and just talk about the poetic Edda or the prose Edda. It's very dense material and that Snorri Sturluson wrote down about pre-Christian ideas. But I think the one reason I chose the Saga of the Volsungs to cover was because you can have these conversations within the context of a standard human drama, because Odin sort of inserts himself in different places. Mm-hmm. And other saga characters are mentioned, I'm sorry, mythological characters are mentioned as well. And so then you can sort of talk about those, and then people go, oh, I understand. Yeah.
And do you think that was maybe by design by the authors of this? Is they were maybe thinking, how could we bring these stories of whatever philosophy or of the gods in a human narrative so that people could understand?
Yeah, it's possible that it was a way to teach people these ideas in sort of an entertaining way. Mm. I'm not sure exactly if that's the case or if it was so, they were so ensconced in it at the time that it was just a natural way of thinking for them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that's definitely a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're reading these, what is that process like? Do you wake up in the morning, have your coffee, read a chapter? Are you taking notes? And then you put that into this kind of summary post. What's that process like?
Yeah, hey, usually I'm like, oh no, I got to do this. And I grab the book in the morning. And I try to do it at least a day before, if not a few days before, and schedule a post on it, reflect on it a little bit, what's happening in the story. You know, one thing that Brindis told me is that, you know, there's the story, there's what happens in the story, and then there's what the meaning or the relationships of the people and what it is that is sort of the meta level of the story. And so to the extent I can, I try to incorporate those broader themes into each week. Sometimes it gets a little repetitive because it's the same theme, but I try to incorporate those ideas. What do I take notes? I do take notes, like I mentioned, for the genealogies. And in some of the sagas that I've covered, I will focus the first few posts on the genealogies, and I'll make trees out of it so that people can see, you know, how characters are related and where they, what part of Norway they came from, and who were their great grandparents, and how that sort of filters down to the people in the story, and sometimes that's important to understand the kinship structures that then guide the narrative. So I'll definitely take notes there. Other than that, I usually, sometimes I'll consult other sources, like either articles, academic articles, or podcasts. Depending on the saga and how difficult it is to kind of get an idea of what other people are thinking about or talking about when they talk about the story, and that usually helps present some ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you ever, I suppose audiobooks would be another option, listening to these sagas as audiobooks.
Absolutely. I think that's perfectly fine. I think we have this misunderstanding that we have to read that, you know, this kind of feeling, maybe it comes from elementary school, that if we're not reading the book, then we should be ashamed. But there's a lot of ways to learn a story. And in fact, you know, traditionally these stories were told orally. And even up until recently, people would talk about the stories. They would also read them, but they would talk about them and communicate them orally. So I think audiobooks are a perfectly fine way to learn about a story, and as are podcasts or other media. And then go back and read it, and I can guarantee you'll get more enjoyment out of it than if you just read it straight.
Well, and as you mentioned, if these stories started out through oral tradition, then it's almost like going back to the original version if you're listening to it on an audiobook.
Yeah.
And absolutely. That also makes me think of the audio-guided museums, of which I know of at least three in Iceland. They have the Saga Museum in Reykjavik, which I hadn't been to, but on the Icelandic Roots trip, we did go to the Leif Erikson Center in Búðadalur, and that one goes through the Vinland sagas, which is the Erik the Red saga, and then the saga of the Greenlanders, and kind of combines those. And then the settlement center in Borgarnes, which is the Book of Settlement, I believe, and then Egil's saga. Yep. And those, I think, are really great, too, for, you know, kind of first time. And then it's also not only audio guided, but you go through the displays. And
yeah, see, I just love the Settlement Center was just so fantastic. And the artwork, that wooden artwork that's sort of hypnotizes you as you're listening to the stories of A.X. Skallagrimsson and the Book of Settlements and sort of understanding. I thought that was just fantastic.
Yeah. And do you have any comments on Egil's saga?
I think it's a, you know, it's a complicated and interesting saga. We don't understand this concept of the berserker. You know, what is a berserker? We know, we seem to think that it's a person who maybe took some type of drug and then became in this kind of rage state and would go to battle. But Aexcala Grimson is supposedly a berserker. So we learn, and in some sagas, the berserkers are depicted as sort of bad guys that come to like bully and harm people. And then usually the hero of the story, you know, saves the regular folk from them. But in that saga, he's the main character and he's depicted as a berserker. And he does go into these rages, and his family, his wife, sort of confronts him about that. And so that's kind of interesting. I mean, that is an amazing, amazing saga. It really is one of the first. So part of that saga is the story of him losing his sons. And he writes this epic poem called Sonatoric, which is the loss of my sons. And what's really remarkable about that is that it was the first evidence of literature from the psychological perspective, that he's talking about his own internal feelings and thoughts. A lot of the sagas focus on the behaviors of what people do, you know, like she went here, she did this, or if they appear angry, it's through their behavior, but or happy or whatever. But this really was a reflection and an introspection on his part about how he was going to continue life after the death of his sons. And it's a beautiful poem. And the saga itself is fantastic. So it's definitely in the top three for, you know, ones that you should read. And yeah.
Yeah. And again, with a wonderful museum exhibit, if anyone can visit it in Borgarnes, which is not too far from Reykjavik. So I think that's within the realm of possibilities if you are in Iceland. And now I don't want to take up too much more of your time if you have to leave here shortly. But the next two sagas that I at least would like to delve into myself, and I'm not sure if you've covered either of these in the members group or if you've read them yourself, but it's the so-called Vinland sagas, right? So the saga of Eric the Red and then the saga of the Greenlanders. So do you have any experience with those ones?
So I have read those sagas, and I wrote a post for Icelandic Roots about the Vinland sagas. They're different. Of course, they're very interesting from a historical standpoint because, you know, they cover supposedly the Europeans finding America long before Columbus. And now there's evidence that it's actually true that, you know, they found a site at Lonesome Meadows in Newfoundland. And the sagas sort of, well, the physical world now confirms that this is what, this is what actually happened. And, you know, I think if you read the saga of Eric the Red and the saga of the Greenlanders, they tell slightly different stories. And so part of the question is what probably happened and what maybe was fiction. And that's hard to discern. But it's clear that people went to Greenland first, and then from there they went on up to Labrador and, well, probably Baffin Island. So if you're on the west coast of Greenland at the settlement site there at Brattahlid, it's in the south, and the whole east coast of Greenland is just ice sheets. You can't really settle it, but the western coast is protected, and it's clear that with the way the currents flow, they probably hugged the coast of Greenland on the west side going north from their settlement, and then cut across real quickly, kind of like crossing a street really fast where there's cars coming, and were then at Baffin Island, and then came down along the coast through Labrador, and then down into the area of Newfoundland and probably even the Vinland, is thought to be somewhere around Nova Scotia, and it could even be farther south, as far away as Massachusetts, if they would have hugged the northeastern coast even further.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a fascinating story, and we don't really know. There's some consistencies between the two story and some unique events, and but you know, if you read both of those stories, it's clear there's likely this guy, Bjarni Herolfsson, who was the first person to kind of see North America, and because he's the one who came back and talked about it, and that it was Leif Erikson who was probably the first European to set foot, or he and his group, on North American soil. And then another one of, and he was the son of Eric the Red, and then another one of his sons, Thorvald, led his own expedition, but it was kind of a failed expedition, as did Thorstein. And then there are two other really important people in those sagas, and that's Thorfinn Karlsefni and Gudrider, who were married and led the first voyage to settle in Vinland. And Gudrider gave birth to Snorri, who was the first European child born in North America and is the namesake for the Snorri program, because it connects the connection to North America. They ended up going back to Iceland, and you and I were there at their farm at near Glombayr, where they came back and settled. And so, but it's kind of fascinating to think that you and I, and if you go into the Icelandic Roots database, a lot of other people, you know, have an ancestor who was living and born in North America and living there and then came back. And then, you know, 800 years later, we come back and now we're all in North America. So yeah, it's a fascinating story and worth a read.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. And that's a good sort of summary. And I understand that like general story, but I feel like for me, there's something more to kind of learn. And there are still mysteries. There's still archaeological gaps and where exactly these explorers were going at that time. But in terms of the feasibility of it, I mean, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And like you said, there is more archaeological evidence that proves this now. But I mean, just imagine discovering Iceland in the first place and sailing through the North Atlantic and just happening upon this relatively small island and then going from there to Greenland and North America. I mean, of course, that seems within the realm of what they could do. But then I guess the big mysteries are, why didn't they stay in North America? And then why did eventually the Norse settlements in Greenland collapse? So interesting things to ponder. And once again, the Leif Erikson Center in Búðadalur is another great place in Iceland, which goes over both of those sagas and that story within their museum setting. Jason, is there any other things you would like to talk about before we wrap up? And I will also ask as well, beyond your different posts that you do weekly in the Icelandic membership group, do you take those and put them together then in an article for Icelandic Roots? Do you capture those summaries of the sagas somewhere else?
I do. Usually after we finish the saga, then I'll write a blog post about it. So I've got several based on the sagas we've covered so far. I started doing these with sagas from East Iceland because that's where a lot of North American Western Icelanders came from. And those are kind of lesser known sagas. So I thought, well, this will be fun. We'll start with these ones that people haven't really heard of. You know, everyone's written about Grettir Saga or Gisli Saga. And so we did that. And then we've been moving on to other sagas and more popular sagas. And yeah, usually we write a blog post that kind of summarizes or tells something about the story. And those are available on our website.
Yeah, very cool. So everyone can access those on the articles or blog section of the website. But then if you want them, those weekly posts, and then you can comment as well and engage more and ask you directly questions about them within the Facebook membership group. So that's for anybody who has an Icelandic Roots membership. You can join that Facebook group. And then also if you don't have a membership, you can, well, get a membership and then have access to that group and all the other fantastic things.
Yeah. And the blogs are for the public also. So those are just free on the website.
Yeah, and I find and often...
Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I was just going to say, I find often like I'm researching different things about Icelandic history, and Icelandic roots, our blogs or different posts come up as like the only result for right. different niche things of Icelandic history. So there really is so much captured there for people that are interested or studying or learning these things.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar, that some of the sagas we cover, it's like one of the few places you'll find anything free on the internet that, that covers that particular saga. So,
yeah, which I think is really important and also still kind of bewilders me. Like, as popular as Iceland is getting more and more, and people talk about and reference these things, and as we were mentioning, the pop culture, you know, inspiration that is always around us, but yet there's so many of these aspects of Icelandic history that is not really covered or is not easily available online. So there's a lot of cool stuff out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a lot of fun. And, you know, the saga books are all in paperback. They're not that expensive. There's a lot of English translations. You can also read them online for free. There's a saga, saga.org. I'll have to look it up. But basically, it's all the Icelandic sagas and older translations. They're usually written around the turn of the century, so some of the language is a little antiquated in English, the translation, but they're readable and they're good. And other than that, you can buy the Penguin Classics or some of the other publishers that have translated sagas into English.
Great. So as we wrap up, two questions. What is your next saga that you're reading? And what are you looking forward to upcoming with different Icelandic roots things?
So the first question is easy to answer. I haven't chosen it yet. Sometimes I like to pull the people who are reading and say which one, I'll give them a couple choices, say which would you like to cover. I'd really like to do Laxdala Saga. I think we haven't done that yet, and that's such a fantastic saga. Saga of Eyxgalla Grimson would be a good one. Yeah, there's a, we still have a lot to choose from. We haven't we've done probably 10, and we there's plenty more to do. What am I looking forward to with regard to Icelandic roots? Well, right now I'm working on a piece on Jakob Sigurdsson and the Melsted Edda, which he was a sort of a scribe and a poet and an illustrator, and he made many of the images that you see today that pertain to sort of Norse mythology and those stories. And the Melsted Edda is a book that came to North America with immigrants, and it was a precious document that is basically, you know, a national treasure, one of Jakob Sigurdsson's books that illustrates those stories. So I've talked to the Melsted family, and I've talked to some Norse scholars, and I'm writing a story right now about him and his connection to North American Icelanders and the book and how it's part of our story. So
Very cool. Well, thank you very much, Jason. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. And if you are interested in joining the aforementioned private Facebook members group, first and foremost, you need to be a member of Icelandic Roots. And if you are, come and join that Facebook group. It's a wonderful page where you can ask questions if you're wondering about anything as it relates to the database and your family genealogy, or all of the other fun things that we discuss in there, such as the saga that the sagas that Jason reviews and writes about within the members only Facebook group. Now, if you're not a member of Icelandic Roots, and if you have Icelandic ancestry, you can join and access all of your family genealogy and all the other dynamics of genealogy. You can see who's related to who and all that sort of fun stuff, as well as lots of historical information, maybe about your family or other Icelandic relatives that you have. Now, if you're not of Icelandic ancestry, you can still join with the basic membership and get access to all of the private members events, the Facebook page, the like book club, and all those sorts of things. So I would really highly advise you, if you're interested, to check it out. Just visit the Icelandic Roots website. So thank you all for listening, and stay tuned for more fantastic episodes in store.